am real excited about parenting. For some reason, it's something that I've been passionate about my whole life. And I think part of that reason is that I grew up in a home with a lot of, with alcoholism and mental illness. And life was rough. And when I became a parent, I was terrified. I just thought, you know, how on earth am I ever going to be a good parent? I don't know anything about it. And I remember one day when my child, my first child was only about 2 weeks old, just sitting next to his little crib and crying and thinking, God, I know that I love this child, but I have absolutely no idea how to help him know that I love him. And during the first year and a half of his life, I read 25 books. Some of them are on this list that we'll that's on the back table, and I'd like to highlight a few of those books. But it's something that you can engage in your whole life. You know, there's the whole, how do I help them know that I love them when they're really little? And then how do I help guide their lives? And then now that I'm an adult, my kids are adults, and I have grandchildren, you know, well, how do I be a good mother of an adult? You know, what do my kids need, and what do they not need, you know, from me in their lives? And what is a good grandparent? I didn't have any grandparents around. What would it, you know, I don't have any idea. And so I feel like I'm learning and growing and being excited about this topic my whole life. And it's a cool thing, because being a parent is, I think, is one of the most wonderful gifts that God can give to us. And I, so that's why I'm here, because I'm excited about parenting, and I'm excited about the fact that there are new kids in this world. And I believe that children, not only are they God's gift to us, but they are a sign of hope for the future. You know, anybody who's willing to have a child, or maybe not so willing but has a child, one way or another, you know, it's something, it's about the future, and it's something that we can build for and something that we can get really excited about. I know that every one of you is here because you love your child. You know, nobody gets up on a Saturday morning and comes in here because you don't care. And so I'm excited to see you here for that reason. And I also believe that God chose you specifically, for your child. And that it wasn't an accident that your kid showed up in your family. And I know that DNA is a big deal, and we all talk about it all the time, but I still believe that God is in charge of DNA, and that he gave you the right child, you know, and he gave them the right parent. So I also believe that you can do it. You know, if you, like I, were full of fear and trembling when your first baby came along and remained that way for years afterwards, it's okay. And I think that we should be a little bit concerned, a little bit. I don't want to say we should live with anxiety by any means, but I think that this is something that should be on our minds. And I think that if we're not feeling any sense of turmoil about how things are going with our children, then we're kind of out of touch, because we live in a tumultuous world. And so feeling that turmoil is okay. There's not a parent on earth who's connected with their child who doesn't think, you know, what's going on and what should I do? Professionally, I started out as a nurse. I worked in an ICU, in a trauma ICU on the outskirts of Chicago, next to one of the busiest freeways in the world. So you can imagine that it was a very busy kind of a life. It was very challenging, and there was a lot of decisions to make, a lot of quick decisions to make. And I loved it. I just was an adrenaline junkie and loved that kind of environment. And so my biggest fear was that when I had children and was going to stay home with them, that I would be bored. You know, oh no, I'll be at home and I'll be bored. And I remember one day when I was pregnant, I was sitting in an ICU in Chicago in the midst of all this chaos. And I was sat down for a moment to do something, and I thought, boy, I'm really bored, you know? And I just had to laugh at myself. If in the midst of all this stimulation, it has become routine enough to me that on that particular day I felt bored, then probably it's okay if I feel bored a day or two when I'm at home. But you know what? I wasn't bored at home. I loved it, you know, and wasn't bored by being a parent. Because it's so stimulating. In fact, there were many, many times when I thought, you know, I think being a parent is harder than being a critical care nurse. Because when it's, you know, in our professional life, there are formulas, and there are procedures, and there are anticipated outcomes, and there are all this structure and all this equipment and all these ways to deal with things. And even if it doesn't work out, we go home and somebody else comes in, you know? But with parents, I think we've all noticed, you know, it's just not like that. We carry a lot on our shoulders. And if you don't come away with anything else today, go away with this idea. You can do it, because God has given you the resources to be a good parent. You know, you can do it. And so that's my message, because I was terrified about being a parent, and it's turned out okay. So not that my kids are okay. My kids are marvelous. I was an okay parent. but my kids are fantastic. Anyway, I am an optimist, and I see every new generation as a new opportunity to see God at work and to see the marvelous things that he can do. So today, I think that our topic was growing successful and happy children. That's because Sherry calls me or sends me an email months ahead of time. She says, what do you want to talk about? And I say, oh, I don't know. How about this? You know? And then I jot down a few ideas about it. And then the week before we get together, I start thinking seriously about, now, what exactly did I have in mind there? And so I decided that the chopping off the bite of successful and happy was just a little too much for today. So we're going to talk about success, because one hinges on the other anyway. And we're going to talk about what is success for our children, not how to make us be successful parents, but what is, how do we define success for our children? And we want to look at what our goal is, because we really can't get anywhere if we don't know what the goal is. And one thing I want to point out is that success is something that cannot be built by us and handed to them. Success is not something that can be built by us and handed to them. Success is something that they are going to have to build all by themselves. If their life is going to be a life of successful adults, there are things that they're going to need to build in. And that we as parents, we want guarantees, we want control. You know, that beautiful baby that's sitting in the back row there, you know, we want to be able to say that this baby is going to be this kind of person, and this baby is going to have this kind of life, you know? And we don't have guarantees or control, but we do have an important role to play in their future. We have a foundational role, and even though we will make a lot of mistakes, and even though now that my kids are 29 and 30, I'd look back and think, oh, I wish I'd done this, or I wish I'd done that, nonetheless, the positive things that we do in our kids' lives will provide for them a foundation that they will walk on for their whole life. And we don't have to be perfect parents. And every day there's a reset button. That's the cool thing about being parents. You know, every day you get up and it's a new day, and things can be different. So I think the most important thing we can do in talking about success is to think realistically about where we want to go and then go there boldly. You know? We just need to decide where we're going with our kids. When our children were young, we lived about 1,000 miles up the Amazon River. And oddly enough, there's a city of about 1 million people there. There's jungle, jungle, jungle for hundreds of miles. And then there's this giant city, and then there's nothing else but jungle all around it due to the rubber boom long ago. But anyway, with that many people and with 70% of it being slum, not very many people had cars, and so there were thousands of buses going everywhere. And my husband always used to say that if you didn't know where you were going, it really didn't matter what bus you took. And that's, I think that's super appropriate to parenting. If we don't know where we're going, we can do anything we want. You know, it doesn't really matter. But if we know where we're going, if we have an idea of where we want to go, then it's really important what bus we take. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about today, which bus we're going to get on. But we need to define success. And sometimes we think about our children's future, and we don't really think about success in real specific terms. We just think, I want my child to be happy. I mean, who doesn't want their child to be happy? We want to see them to feel good about life and feel good about themselves. We long to see a sense of well-being. And you know, we were created to long for a sense of well-being. The Hebrew term shalom in the Old Testament, basically that's what that means, being at peace, being in the relationships that God created us for, not being in conflict with other people or with God or with nations around us. This shalom, this well-being, that's what we were made to long for. And so it's okay for us to want them to be happy when they grow up. We long for peace, and we long for everyone getting along. Anybody who has a household who has 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds, you know, we long for everybody getting along. What are the ages of the kids that are represented here? Anybody has, how many babies? Babies, toddlers, preschoolers, school-age kids, teenagers, any teenagers, parents of teenagers? Yeah, okay. Well, we got everything here. All right, good. Also we really want them to love us. You know, that's a really, really big motivating factor in parenting. And I think that sometimes it's helpful for us to examine that a little bit and realize that a lot of what we do is motivated by a desire for them to love us. And sometimes we are actually counterproductive in our parenting because we want that feeling of love, that feeling of peace right now, without really thinking about how does that develop our love relationship in the long term. Well, we'll get to all that, kind of some of those things, but I just wanted to say in the beginning, we do want them to be happy and that there's nothing wrong with wanting them to be happy. And that when we look at goals for success, happiness is not some other thing, you know. But I really believe that both success and happiness are byproducts of life, and they're not what life is itself. And I'm sure you believe that too. But let's think about it a little bit. One question I have is success the same for every generation? We'll, I'm going to talk in a little while about my grandparents and my parents and my generation and my kids and then looking at their kids. But I want to plant this idea that our definition of success changes from generation to generation. And what not only what a successful life is and looks like, but what it takes to have a successful life also changes from generation to generation. But I want to look for a moment at... And then the question, of course, is will the values and the definitions of success that I have today be adequate for them in the long run? But let's start off with Zach and Zoe. Those are really popular names for the generation of your children. And so I want to just take a look at what do we aspire to for them? What do we hope that their life is going to look like in 10 or 15 or 20 years? So let's get like really specific about it. Oops, am I going the wrong way? Okay. What kind of level of education do we hope that our kids are going to have? Thoughts? College degree? Does everybody here want their kids to go to college? You don't look so sure about that. What are you thinking?
I'm not sure if it's for them.
You're not sure if it's for them? Yeah. Okay. So... But we want our kids, okay. But a lot of us want our kids to go to college. Does anybody want something different, more or less?
I think they need higher.
They need what? Higher than college. Okay, you want your kids to get like a master's degree?
Or a doctorate?
Okay. Okay, we're defining success here. So let's just be honest. What would we be happy to see in our children's lives in 10, 15, 20, 30 years? Okay, level of education is one. How about a profession? What kind of professions would we like our children to have? Shout it out. What would you like to see your kid be?
One that meets their skill set.
One that meets their skill set, okay. Nobody has a specific profession in mind? No? Physical therapy. You'd like to have your child be a physical therapist?
Yeah.
Why? Just out of curiosity. Because your husband does that? It works well? Okay.
Just job in large numbers.
Job in large numbers. Oh, you want that? Yeah. Okay, you want them to have a profession that there are a lot of jobs available for. Okay, got that. Anything else?
I want something that they've dreamed about.
You want something that they've dreamed about. Okay, so they're going to have to start dreaming if they're going to get that. They have. Okay. What do your children dream about?
I have one that wants to go military.
Uh-huh. Military? Archaeologist, marine biologist, yeah. Right, all those ones that aren't practical for living in Columbus, Ohio, but look a lot of fun. Yeah, dreaming is good. Dreaming is a really good thing. Okay, so we do have ideas about professions. Would it be okay if our child is an electrician? Electrician. Is that okay? Would it be okay if our child decides to be a waiter? Yeah? Now, are we nodding our heads and agreeing because that's politically correct or because we really want to see our kids be waiters for most of their lives, professional lives? Okay. We're just thinking here. We're totally thinking out loud. All right. What kind of income do we want our children to have?
Enough that they can pay their bills and be responsible.
Enough that they can pay their bills and be responsible. Give me a figure here. What would you like to see? In today's dollars, it'll be totally different in 20 years, but in today's dollars, what would you like to see your kids earn? $60,000? If they have a family, it's going to have to be more. What do you think?
I think it has to be over 100 grand.
Has to be over 100 grand. Anybody else? Something where the mom can stay at home? Okay, so we want a fairly high level of income for that to happen. Okay. We're being honest, and I think that this is really important. We need to think about what exactly is it that I want in my kids' lives. And we can't guarantee it and we can't control it, but we can think about, because the way we view the future, the way we view our children's future, has a tremendous impact on the way we parent them today. Okay. What about living conditions? What do we want for them? Do we want them to be able to rent an apartment? Do we want them to
own a home?
Okay. Would we be disappointed if our kids weren't able to own a home? No? Okay.
Probably.
Yeah. Okay. We've got a probably, a yes, a no. Okay. We're all over the place here. What about their family situation? Would you like your kids to grow up and get married? Anybody wants their kids to grow up and get married? Anybody here wants grandkids? Oh, we're getting a lot of nodding on the growing up and getting married and the having grandchildren. You're barely dealing with your little kids and you already want grandchildren, huh? Okay. Well, I can say that being a grandparent is quite fun. So we need to think then about goals and about a lifestyle and about a relational style and a relational maturity that would bring them to the point that they would be able to have a marriage and hopefully a marriage that was stable enough to then have children. So that's a goal. What about their spiritual life? What do we hope for in terms of spiritual life? Say that again.
A strong
spiritual life. Okay. More specific than that. We want them to, yes. Okay. So yeah, we want to put spiritual life on the top of the list instead of on the bottom of the list. Okay. What does that mean? Does that mean that they spend more time praying and being spiritual than they do going to work? That we want our kids to be leaders in other people's lives, okay? We want our kids to have something spiritual to offer, not just to sustain their own lives, but to sustain and encourage the lives of others. Anything else? Okay. What about my relationship with them when they are adults? Is it okay with me if they move to Manchuria, and I see them once every couple of years, on furloughs or on whatever, or if I can get over there? Do I want them to want to come home? Do I want them to call me every day, and tell me what they're doing, and chat? Do I want them to see them once a week? You know, I mean, maybe some of these sound like really silly questions, but people are all over the board here with our expectations. And sometimes it's helpful to sit down and think about it. And that's why I have this handout, and you can write in. What would you ideally like to see? You know, and I see people who are adults, who are 30-year-old adults, who call their parents every day. And then I think we all see people who are adults, and they rarely see their parents, either because of geography or relationship, and maybe they see each other once a year at Thanksgiving or something like that. You know, what are we looking for? What are we hoping for? Is there anything you really, really do not want to see happen?
I don't want to just see him every holiday.
You don't want to just see him every holiday? Okay. Yeah?
I don't want my children to get caught up in a lot of the worldly traps.
I don't want my children to get caught up in worldly traps like drugs and alcohol. Okay.
Anything else? To be a productive citizen, but also to know the Lord.
Yeah, be a productive citizen of the Lord. Okay. Well, let's move along a little bit here and think about this. Oh, social and hobbies, is that important to us? We want to see our kids have outlets and hobbies. Oddly enough, now that I've spent most of my life trying to help my kids be directed in spiritual development and in leadership and in this and in that, I'm seeing now that it would be really good to help them open doors to hobbies too. You know, to have other things to do, both with their kids and then also to kind of chill a little bit from the stresses of life that they have to deal with. Do you think that these definitions that we have given today are common to our culture? Yeah? Some of them. Most of them, I think, are. The education, profession, income, all those kinds of things are pretty common to what our culture is interested in. Do we want our kids to fit into the culture around them?
Yes.
Yes? That was definite. Okay, so what do you mean?
Well, to not be of the world, to be in the world.
Yeah.
So to not stand out, like, sort of, I'm like, oh, you're a weirdo.
Okay, not to stand out as somebody strange. Okay.
Also, to be different in a way that's not compelling.
To be visibly different in a positive way. Okay. In what ways do we want our kids to be different? And I'm asking all these questions not because we're going to come up with some definitive answer right now, but because I really, really believe that these are things that are worth meditating on. They're worth taking the paper home and putting it by our bedsides and or wherever it is that we spend our time thinking and reading and praying and really thinking through these questions. What do we want? How do we want them to be the same, and how do we want them to be different? And here's a question. Are there any non-negotiables? Are there any things that are non-negotiables in how we want our kids to be, you know, as adults? When we moved back from Brazil, our children were in their late teens, having finished high school, having gone to a Brazilian high school, having not really spoken English with anybody but us hardly for about 5 years. And they had a very, very different cultural mindset and a very, very different just way of looking at life than the kids that they met when they came back to Columbus, Ohio, and Ohio State University in Zenas. And it was a huge life transition. And it was really hard for them to know what it meant to fit in and be a North American young person. And so one of the conversations that we had to have is, how do you want to be the same as everybody else? How do you want to be different? And are there any non-negotiables? And, you know, are you willing? Obviously, I can tell by looking at you that you're willing to dye your hair and, you know, and get a piercing and change your clothes and do this and do that, you know. The way you talk is different. You know, I can hear the slang and the different, all this. But what are you not willing to change about who you are? You know, and I think that is a significant question about what are the non-negotiables? You know, because all the cultural stuff is going to be totally different, you know, in 30 years or 20 years or even 10 years. But what are the non-negotiables? What are the things that matter to us? If our kids come home, you know, when I was in a teenager in the 70s, the big deal was what we looked like in terms of clothing and hair. You know, and my parents would just go nuts over my brother's shoulder-length hair and over the kind of music that we listened to. And my mother said I looked like a tramp when I walked out the door. And she didn't mean that in a sexual way. She meant it in a hobo on the street way from the 30s, you know, because I wore jeans that had holes in them and things like that. It was very upsetting to her because she wanted me to look like, you know, a college-bound princess or something like that, you know, which was her ideal of what a teenager should look like. And I remember thinking back then, what will my children do? What will my generation's children do that will freak me out as much as, you know, long hair and crummy clothes did to my parents? You know, and then, of course, then piercings and tattoos came along, and I was like, oh, yeah, never thought about that. You know, and somehow our children's generation will come up with something that is even more exotic to them and fascinating than piercings and tattoos, and we need to be ready to think about, you know, what are the non-negotiables? All right. Let's describe Zach and Zoe. I picked the names Zach and Zoe because they are kind of popular names for this generation. Their personality is already there, but what we have a profound effect on are attitudes and values. And we need to think, what will they need to live this successful life that we're hoping for them to have? And I want to take some time to think about, what will life really be like? Because I really think that our thinking about the future needs to be realistic. And to do that, I want to look at Harry and Lola from 1900. And Harry and Lola were my grandparents, and they were the generation that went to World War I. And they were a primarily agricultural generation. Almost everyone in the United States lived in small towns and or on farms at that point. And so their life was really, really different. And success for them meant being able to feed and clothe their children and maybe own a house. Home ownership was not a given by any means in that generation. And what they really wanted was to have kids that would grow up and have kids, you know, and be able to take care of them. And then there's the Frank and Rosie generation. That's my parents' generation. I don't know if anybody remembers Rosie the Riveter from World War II, you know, the whole propaganda thing about getting women out there into the factories. Well, that's the Depression and World War II generation. And their idea of success was hugely different than their parents' idea of success. What did they want? that was different than what their parents wanted. Anybody know from history, from ancient ramblings of their parents and grandparents? They wanted, this is when the American dream started to come, you know, be talked about. They were the first generation to move into the cities, to get a better education, to live in an industrialized society, to get 9-to-5 jobs. The weekend was invented during this time. People before that, Harry and Lola didn't know what a weekend was when they were growing up, and so they didn't know what leisure was really when they were growing up in the same way. And so the Depression and World War II shaped Frank and Rosie's generation significantly, because it shook up the whole way that they lived, and it moved them into cities where their extended family was no longer available to help them out with things. Another thing that it did was it produced my generation, which is Dick and Jane. Dick and Jane, see Dick, see Jane, see Spot Run. I don't know if you guys ever saw any of those old books. That's how I learned how to read. And that was the boom times, and I mean educationally boom times as well as having lots and lots of children. And education changed radically during this time. Why did education change so much? Because of the GI Bill. Millions of people came back, millions of men and women came back from the armed services, and they went to college free on the GI Bill. And so suddenly, everything changed. You know, in Harry and Lola's time, Lola went to her grave bitter because she'd had to quit school at sixth grade because of family problems and all that. But it was normal to not finish school. And suddenly the standard became going to college in my generation. I knew when I was in kindergarten that I was going to go to college. It was just expected. In fact, I was in high school before I actually met someone who had not been to college. So it was really something that formed, you know, the expectations of my generation. But we grew up in an economic boom time, and everything was getting better, and we believed in progress. Everything was getting better and better all the time. Well, in your generation, I'm calling you guys Jeremy and Sarah, there became a huge fragmentation in our culture because of the fact that my generation grew up and went to college and went to work and changed significantly the way family life was run. How many of you were brought up with a mom at home? A few, okay. How many of you were brought up in a home with divorce? Okay. How many of you were brought up in a home where you were geographically separated from your grandparents? All right. Well, there's a lot of this fragmentation in all of those different ways that occurred more in your generation than in any other generation in history. And so that became a real significant factor in the way you guys grew up. Well, Zach and Zoe are dealing with 9/11. Now, what impact does that have? I mean, that is the defining, in many ways, as Pearl Harbor was the defining event for my parents' generation, 9/11 is the defining event for our times. What implications does that have for who Zach and Zoe are going to be and what their opportunities will be in 30 years? Any ideas? Fearful, okay. I think fear is a huge element of our era. What else? Yeah?
I wish I could encapsulate this in one or two words, but basically a pursuit of something that's going to guarantee security.
Okay, a pursuit of something that will guarantee security. I think that is a huge thing. The pursuit of security is something that drives our society in really profound ways. When we think about success today, we think about success in terms of security and in terms of circling the wagons. You know, we no longer have, when I was in college, the world was laid out before me, you know, and I knew that I could travel to different places. And you know, when I wound up in, you know, up the Amazon in Brazil with my kids, I thought that was kind of normal. You know, but I think that there's, and even though there are more and more kids going abroad on youth study trips, which I think are absolutely wonderful. I could, you know, we could talk about that someday. I think it's fantastic and wonderful for that to happen. But when people are having children and when people are establishing their adult lives, there's a whole lot more circling the wagons going on than I think we've seen in a really, really long time. And unfortunately, we're circling smaller wagons. You know, the Harry and Lola, when they circled the wagons, they were circling their grandparents and their aunts and uncles and cousins and everybody else too. And they may have had very insular relationships and insular societies, but they were fairly large compared to ours. When we circle the wagons, it's me and my husband and my kids and, you know, maybe a few friends. And so it's a very, very different kind of world. But the whole point of putting this all up here is that things change. Expectations change significantly. When I was growing up, the big American dream and the economic boom, you know, was all about that. But when I got married in the 70s and 80s, we had a situation of high unemployment, high inflation, the housing market where you could get a loan if you put at least 10% down and had a mortgage rate of 14 to 16% interest. How many of us were able to buy houses? Not too many, you know. And right now it's in a really easy time. Both of my kids just bought houses last year. And I'm like, how can this happen? You're still children. How can you own a home, you know? Well, they're not still children. They can own a home. But what I'm saying is that things that we take for granted today, assumptions that we have now, may be radically different in 10 years or 20 years. And so when we think about parenting, we think about success, we have to get rid of the idea that we can have a picture of what that's going to look like. Because world events are changing radically. A lot of things can happen. And with all the uncertainties with politics and economics, is it possible, we need to ask ourselves, is it possible that the successful life that we want to prepare them for may not exist in 30 years? Did you ever think about that? The successful world that we want to prepare them for may not exist in 30 years. Is that a little bit sobering? It should be, I'm sure it is. Today's assumptions may or may not hold true for 2010 and 2030. There may not be any credit to buy homes. Actually, most of the world works this way. If you live in the developing world or in most of the world, what you see is people live with their parents, and in the meantime, they buy bricks by the 2,000 lots, and the bricks sit in the backyard for years. And then they buy other things, and then they buy other things, and pretty soon they've got this whole mound of stuff. And eventually, they're able to buy some space, and they dig a foundation, and they put up the first, and it takes them like 10 years, and then they build their houses. That's the way most of the people in the entire world do it. And so there might not be credit to buy houses. There might have to be different ways of doing things. Colleges may be primarily online. College campuses' life may become so expensive and or some so security difficult that most people may not even go to college. The assumption that I was born with, that I would go to college, may not be practical for our kids in 10 or 20 years. Things could change that much. The social and political and economic factors are constantly changing. So one of the things we need to keep in mind is that every generation is radically different. Now, is anybody finding this just a little bit sobering and or depressing? Yeah, it can be. But you know what? Has anybody here living an adult life that's different than what they thought it would be 10 years ago? I sure am, you know. I mean, if you had told me 10 years ago that I would be living in Columbus, Ohio, and working as an artist, I would have been flabbergasted. I would not have believed that that was possible. And yet, life situations change, and things happen, and it's amazing how life can be different than what we planned about. Now, we are not talking about the apocalypse here. We're talking about normal, generation to generation, decade to decade, economic, political, social change. You know, and I want to just say here that I love history, and I'm very excited about the future. I've been reading A Brief History of the World. I highly recommend these two books. A Brief History of the World by Geoffrey Blainey and A Brief History of the 20th Century, also by Geoffrey Blainey. And I love history, and part of the reason that I love history is because it is full of human experience. It is full of turmoil. History basically is about talking about wars and then some plagues and some wars and then some political change and then a few more wars and then a plague or two and then another war. I mean, that's really what history is all about. It's humanity coping with the reality of who we are as a race, of who we are as people. And because we have had a relatively long period of prosperity and peace in the United States, we can't really assume that given the spectrum of world history that it's always going to be like this. Why is this reading so encouraging to me? If it's all about wars and difficulties and blunders and plagues, why am I so encouraged by reading about history? Anybody have an idea? I mean, I just get really pumped up about it when I read history. Yeah? we're still here.
It's never as bad as it seems like it's going to be.
It's never as bad as it seems like it's going to be. You know, I mean, lots of bad things happen. Life is pretty uncontrollable. But the point is that God is the one who is at work in history. God is active in every age, and he is faithful, and he is available in every age. And there has never been a moment in humanity when there has not been a vital and alive group of his followers before and after Christ. There have always been people who have been committed to God, and there have always been people through whom God has worked and molded and shaped parts of the world and society. And that's why I get really excited about history, because God is taking us somewhere. It's not just this, you know, oh, this happens and that happens and it's all random. God is taking us somewhere. And so we need to look very realistically at the future, but we can look at it with excitement too, because it's not, things are not that bad. People struggled with their times and God guided them through it. I know my daughter was struggling recently with, you know, her baby is, you know, a year old. We're having the first birthday party this afternoon, and it's a very exciting thing. But then thinking, well, what about the future? You know, what's going to happen? And are these the end times? There's wars and earthquakes, and what's going to happen? You know, and a lot of it, economically, we probably will lose a lot of economic advantages that we have today. But it was nice for my husband to be able to remind her, well, remember when we lived in the Amazon and we had to, you know, like make all of our own food and we had to do this and do that and all that? Well, this is what we're talking about. An economic collapse looks like what you've already experienced. And you know, it wasn't that bad. You still had a good time. You know, you were running around, you didn't even know that you were poor. You were running around, you didn't even realize that there was a problem with the fact that we didn't have a refrigerator. You know, I mean, life just doesn't end. Life can be fun and fulfilling and positive without all the stuff that we have today. And that's a really weird, scary thought, but it's true. It's really true. People struggled in every time, in every era of history, and God guided them and provided for them in every one of them. So it's an accepted fact amongst us today that hard work and focus on the goal produce success. But we have to realize that that is if you live in America. Because believe me, I've lived in other places and visited many, many places of the world, and it's not the case. I've seen people work and work and work and struggle and struggle and struggle for years and years and years and not have any success other than being able to put food on their kids' tables every day. So it's an accepted fact. If you live in America, if you have economic and educational resources, excuse me, and if things stay mostly the same, so those are three fairly significant ifs. But just in case this doesn't work in 2030, just in case this accepted fact that hard work will bring success, just in case that's not going to work, can this be true? Can it be that hardship and a focus outside of self can produce success? Think about that for a minute. Excuse me. Tail end of a 2-week cold. I hope it's the tail end anyway. Can you guys interact with this just a little bit? Give me some ideas, some thoughts. What do I mean? Well, yeah, anytime you're looking at other people more than yourself, it's going to be a positive impact, have a positive impact on your life. What about hardship?
I think hardship hones.
Hardship what?
It kind of hones what you're really about.
It hones what you're really about.
When times get rough, who are you really?
Who are you really?
It's like you said, who are you really about when times get tough?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, since I like to read history, I'm about halfway through A Brief History of the 20th Century right now. And there was a fantastic quote by Winston Churchill that I probably won't remember exactly. But he basically said, during the time that England was being bombarded by the Germans, he said, "This is not a somber day. This is a magnificent day. These are the best days that our nation has ever lived." You know, what's up with that? you know, was he a crazy person? I think there's probably a slide about that later. Was he insane?
With some of the things you were talking about with World War II and 9/11, I mean, half of what all of us remember, you know, is the positives. World War II is looked on as this great time in American history because everybody banded together, everybody worked hard, you know, it brought out the good in everybody. And 9/11 had a lot of that same reaction, that neighbors helping neighbors. And so anytime there's those hardships, we kind of can forget about, you know, does everybody have the house or the nicest car or, you know, whatever it is, it puts a realer focus on what's out there. So
it's a fascinating thing that hardship is so, so good for us. Has anybody gone to a funeral recently? Yeah, I have. When you're at a funeral and you look at somebody's life, or especially if it's somebody important to you, or if you've had a big health scare, what kinds of things come into your minds? Yeah? Say it again, please.
I hope I've had a positive impact on someone else.
Yeah, we start thinking about positive impact. For the vast majority of people that are walking away from funerals, what are they thinking about? They're thinking about relationships. They're thinking about the impact that they had on somebody's life. And you know, knowing that you're having an impact, knowing that what you do matters, knowing that what you do is pulling together to help your community, to help your nation survive, to help your family survive, is an amazingly invigorating kind of a thing. It's a very exciting kind of a thing. I was talking to a mother recently who was really upset because her child had to deal with some difficulty. And to be honest with you, I don't remember what it was. But she was feeling really guilty about it. You know, and I was just trying to say, look, you know, it's so good that your child, you know, who is 8 years old, has to deal with this difficulty. It's such a blessing, you know, that you can walk your kid through this and that you can interpret it with them, you know, and that you can help them see that this hardship that they're going through won't destroy them, that they're tougher than that. Because so much of our life is driven by fear. We fear that hardship. But then when it comes along, we find that we have resources that we never imagined that we had. You know, and God gives us resources that we really didn't have by ourselves. Anyway, let's look at the idea of success again. Are there any other qualities we want Zach and Zoe to develop? We have our list of the successful things in terms of education and income and all that kind of thing, but what else do Zach and Zoe need to move out there into the world of 2030? Character? Let's define that a little bit. What kind of character, what kind of qualities do they need?
People are more important than things.
People are more important than things. Where did you hear that? I just think that's so funny because it's such like a family saying slogan at our house. Yeah, people are more important than things. Yeah. Okay. Laurie?
I think having some flexibility in life, like you were talking about hardship, like I want my daughter to be flexible and I want her to have a soft heart, like those are the things, you know, like she's very strong-willed and I think there are ways that's good, but I think I don't want her to be like me.
Okay, we want our kids to be flexible, we want them to be soft-hearted, we want them to value people more than things. What else? Yeah?
I want my kids to be okay with who they are.
Okay with who they are. What does that mean?
Not constantly comparing themselves to other people.
Okay. Not comparing. That could be an extremely important characteristic to have in 2030, because if there are economic difficulties, if there are changes from things today, and our kids are getting by selling produce from their backyard on the street, they need to know that that's okay because that they're doing what they can do in the situation that they're in and not spend their life pining away thinking that they should be doing something else. Okay? Anything else? This is what we want Zach and Zoe to have, to go to the world ahead of them. Well, I want to say that success grows by indirect means. And this is what I was trying to say in the beginning, that success is not something that we can build for them and hand over when they reach, you know, 18. Success is something that is built in their lives by indirect sorts of things. And it often comes to those who seek inner development. And I think those of us who are here today are all part of the faith community. We really do believe that success comes for those who develop their relationship with Jesus in a living and profound way. And that that living relationship with Jesus, the following the character of Jesus, following the person of Jesus, is so much more important than having a career path from kindergarten to college. There's a film, apparently, there's some advertising about it back there, called Race to Nowhere. And it's a documentary about the silent epidemic in our schools related to anxiety and performance. And I really would recommend that everybody see this. I'm really looking forward to seeing it on May 2nd. But that's a lot of what I'm getting at, is that sometimes the things that we push for in a successful life for our children are not the things that are really going to create a successful, stable life for them as adults, and really not be what's going to make them happy. What we most need to give them for success is a vision for a quality life. If we as parents can implant in them a vision for a quality life, a life that's deeply rooted in God, and a life that develops who they are as God created them to be, we'll be able to help them a lot more to developing success. We teach for success in a lot of different ways. One of the things that we do is that in the way that we're proud of them, and in the way that and what we censure them for. And what I mean by this is that so often when kids are running around the house, and let's say they're 4 and 5 years old, and they're doing this and they're doing that, and you hear a crash, and you go in and they've broken something that you really like, you know, how do you react to that? You know, we get mad, we make a big deal out of it, you know, sometimes we're mad at them for a long time, sometimes we yell at them. It sort of depends on how each of us copes with things like that. But it's a big deal when they break something. Or if they're a little bit older and they broke the TV because they played soccer in the house or whatever, we might make them pay for it over a period of months, you know, doing certain jobs and all that kind of stuff. We make a big deal oftentimes out of material loss. But if they are running around the house and they say mean things to the other kids and the other kids go home crying, what do we do? Is it a big deal? See the difference? So often we punish material loss, but we console or chide over relational losses. Sometimes we, if the friendship, we just say, well, let the friendship go because it's inconvenient. You know, oh, that kid moved just a little bit too far away, or oh, that kid's not good for you because you have conflicts when you get together, or that kid's not good for you for this reason, or that kid's not good for you for that reason. And so often we just kind of let relationships go, but we hold on to that they really need to have certain material kinds of things, or proud or punishing about grades. So when we are teaching for success, we're teaching them the values that we have by the way we respond to things. Also, what we spend our time on. Most of us work and 8 hours a day. Most of our fathers work 8 hours a day, and a lot of the moms do as well, and then there's the commute, and there's a lot of time involved in there. And so we don't have a lot of time. We may have only 3 or 4 hours at home every day, you know, during the week before our kids go to bed. And, you know, how do we deal with this, you know, in the life that we have together? How do we spend our time on? That's going to teach our kids what our priorities are. Are we able to pursue regular fellowship and regular friendships in spite of the limited time that we have? It's a huge statement of what our values are. There's an ad on TV right now that is just really bugging me. I mean, there's often a commercial that, you know, kind of gets under your skin, isn't there? And this one is about harmony and peace in the kingdom. And it's a cable TV ad or DirecTV or whatever. And there's this family of four, and they're all sitting at the dinner table, and they all look really nice and well-dressed, and everybody's just super polite. And you know, the wife is saying, honey, I'll just be really happy to take out the trash for you, you know, if you'd like. If you've seen this commercial, I see some nodding, yeah. You know, and the husband's like, oh, thank you so much. That'll give me time to talk to your mother on the phone for an hour. You know, and the kids are like, well, I can clean up my room before I go, you know. But, and everybody's just, like, happy and in this, like, totally unrealistic idyllic kingdom sort of a way. And what has brought such peace and happiness to their home? Because this cable network promises to provide four separate channels that can come into your house so that you can have four different TVs going on in four different rooms with four different programs at the same time. You know, what an insidious and horrible message that the way to bring about happiness in our home is that we each go to a separate room and engage in some impersonal entertainment activity. It's just like, it's scary. But so for us to take a stand against that kind of splintered living, you know, and to do things with our kids and to engage our kids and to be, you know, really a part of their lives in that little window of time that we have every day is a huge, huge message to them about what a successful future is all about. Also, we teach for success when we talk about what we talk about and what we complain about. You know, what interests us enough to captivate our thinking and our conversation? Think about that. What captivates us enough to think to affect our thinking and our conversation? You know, I mean, I don't have anything against sports and American Idol, but is there anything else that captivates us enough that we want, that we talk over with our kids and that we're excited about and that we want to make sure that they know about? And then another thing is what we talk about is do we help them process the things that happen in their lives? You know, they may come home and they have a disappointment or they have a victory. Do we help them process what that means? This victory, what does this victory mean? Does it mean that you're a good person? Does it mean that you're better than other people? You know, what does this mean exactly? You have a disappointment. Does that mean that you're a bad person? Does that mean that, you know, that you were entitled to something better and you got gypped? You know, and so often what kids need from adults is just processing through their day and seeing how do their parents react to that? And then also the things that we complain about in our own lives. When we talk about how did work go, the way we complain about work and the way we describe the people at work, you know, is hugely impactful to the way that they look at their world. Yep. How do we know if it's the right way to do it, this processing? Anybody have any ideas? How do we know how to process?
The way I was talking about.
What's that?
I think asking them what they think we communicate is important.
Yeah, especially when they get older. You know, what we could ask them, how do they think we view things? They might not tell us, though. Linda? Input from other people.
So you went through this before. How did you deal with it? And, you know, there's a course always praying. It seems to be my last resort.
Praying,
well,
yeah.
God, what do you think about this? But we start a lot with, they come with a problem. What do you think about it? Let's get what they know. And then
Sharon, could you turn the mic up, please?
For us, or we don't understand, then we have an extended group of people we turn to that are veterans.
Well, you know, and we have resources. We have an extended group of people that we can talk to, and we have our spouses that we can talk to. But frankly, an awful lot of what our kids need to process through is so simple. You know, is they just need to say, "Tommy kicked me on the playground today," and we need to say, "Oh, that's really a bummer. So, what's up with you and Tommy?" You know, and just kind of talk it through. You know, a lot of it is really simple. Sometimes we kind of overcomplicate parenting, but really what we need to do is just have dialogue going on. Dialogue about going on about real things that happen to them in their real day. So anyway, what interests us enough to talk about? What do we complain about? How do we present our lives to people? I thought when I was growing up that I lived in a really inferior neighborhood in an inferior house and that we were somehow underprivileged. And the reason for that was because my mother did not like the architectural style of the house we lived in. It was a new build. We were the first occupants. It was a new neighborhood. We had a brand new school, which was, for that era, state-of-the-art school, a block away that we walked to every day. And when I look at that neighborhood now as an adult, I could not afford to live there. And so it's just so, it's so, so bizarre, but I grew up thinking that we were living in a substandard place because my mother wanted, you know, a 1900, you know, arts and craftsmen, you know, large scale house, and she got a modern split level, you know. So the way we talk about, you know, the things of our lives really makes a big difference. Anyway, this funny little drawing here that you see on your paper comes because I had a little netbook that I was trying to draw on. But it's basically showing three different paths. And of course, life is not that simple. But sometimes making it overly simplified can help us to look at some of the excesses. We oftentimes have achievement and recognition as being success, or we have entertainment and good experiences as being happiness. And both of these two things are like detours on the road to what is up on the top right, the maturity and faithfulness. And there's nothing wrong with achievement. There's nothing wrong with education. There's nothing wrong with entertainment or experience. But when those become our goals and the way that we are directing our children as this is the primary thing that we're putting our energy into, then they'll pretty much be guaranteed to miss out on the maturity and faithfulness part. And so what I wanted to say is that success and happiness are byproducts of a life of integrity. They're not things that we can just that we can pursue outright. And this verse here about who we are created to be, I think is hugely significant. We are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works which God prepared in advance for us to do. And that the real success and the real fulfillment and happiness that we or our children are going to have in life is discovering what that is. What did God create me to do, and what did God put me on this earth to do? And one of the things that's sometimes a little bit hard for us to accept is that a lot of the things that happen in our lives that bring out what God has intended for us are hardship. Let's look at a few verses here. Romans 8, 6 through 18. It says that the Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we are God's children. God is so invested in us that he actually comes and lives inside of us, and he gives us that affirmation that we're God's children. Now, if we are children, then we are heirs with God and co-heirs with Christ. If indeed we share his sufferings in order, what? In order to share his sufferings in order that we may share in his glory. Well, that doesn't sound like fun. I like the idea of being an heir of God, but I don't like the idea of sharing in his sufferings. But what were Jesus' sufferings all about? It was about bringing reconciliation, you know, and we do share in his sufferings oftentimes when we commit our lives to sharing reconciliation, to sharing justice. Jesus was all about social justice. Jesus was all about caring for the poor. Jesus was all about bringing forgiveness to other people. And so we do share with that. In 2 Corinthians 4:17, it says, our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So when we fix our eyes on what is not seen, but what is not on what is seen, but what is unseen, since that what is temporary and what is unseen is eternal. So also in Romans 5, 2 through 4, we boast in the hope of the glory of God. Not only so, but the glory of we glory in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, character, and character, hope. And the whole point of bringing up all these verses is not to say that God wants us to have a life of suffering. Not at all. But that suffering is inevitable. Some kind of suffering is inevitable in the life that we have. And it's exciting to know that we have a God who makes the most of that. It's exciting to know that God brings out the best in us. It's exciting to know that Winston Churchill was not insane when he said that these are our nation's brightest days, you know, because it brought out in people a nobility of spirit that gave their lives great meaning and gave them a sense of being able to accomplish and contribute to the lives of others. And so we have all of this like spiritual understanding, and we have this like altruistic idea of how cool it would be if our child was the courageous leader, if our child was the one who sacrificially gave himself to promote the good of other people. And yet in our own life, on the day-in-day level, we live in a completely different way. And so our kids are seeing something that's a little bit schizophrenic, because we have this ideal out here of the spiritual life. We have this ideal of the giving and of the altruism. And yet on the day in and day out, it's what do you want to eat today? And oh, you don't like what I made for you for dinner. I'll make you something else. And how can I serve you? And oh, you know, you have to be there at 10 o'clock for this for this play date, you know, and I have other things I have to, oh, well, we have to, you know, get you for the play, you know, I mean, it's just like, it's good to serve our children, but we sometimes, we are doing something that is so kind of schizophrenic that our kids have a hard time figuring out what we really want when we teach for one thing and we live for another. And so the greater the distance between what we say our goals are and what we demonstrate in our day-to-day living, the greater the confusion that our kids have. So a lot of times, they have a lot of question marks, and we have to ask ourselves, are we raising them as if they were going into a different kind of world than we realistically see that they are? If we look at a given week with our kids, and the way we interact with them, and the kinds of things that we're spending our time on, we have to ask ourselves, are we raising them for that world that might not exist, or are we raising them for the real world that they're going to be encountering ahead of time? Here's an example. How strongly do we feel about their sexual experience before marriage? Anybody have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I hope that they don't have sex before they're married.
You hope that they don't have sex before they're married. Okay. Anybody else? Is that a common thing? Do we all hope that they don't have sex before they're married? Because we see that it's significant to their lives. Well, how come then we let them dress up in really sweet little things, you know, that show everything they've got when they're four, and then say, oh, how cute, you guys are all together here, you know, oh, and is this little one your boyfriend, and wink at them? Why do we do these things? Why do we do these things? Don't you see parents doing that with four-year-olds, you know, and two-year-olds, and eight-year-olds, and 12-year-olds? It's like, you know, wait a minute. What exactly are we, you know, we got one thing and then we got another thing. There was a fascinating article that came out. Somebody put it on Zenos Misk and I read it. It was called, Why Do We Let Our Girls Dress Like This? It's written by a nationally recognized author. And I just want to read to you a couple things. And I realize that I think it's because I have a cold or what. I'm kind of rambly. I don't know what time we're supposed to be done.
11.
Oops. Okay. Let me just read this a little bit, though. What teenage girl doesn't want to be attractive, sought after, and popular? And what mom doesn't want to help in that cause? In the pale turquoise ladies' room, they congregate in front of the mirror, reapplying mascara and lip gloss, brushing their hair, straightening their pantyhose, and gossiping. This one is skanky, that one is really cute, and so forth. Dressed in mini dresses, perilously high heels, and glittery dangling earrings, their eyes heavily shaded with black pearl and jade, they look like a flock of tropical birds. A few minutes later, they return to the dance floor where they shake everything they've got under the party lights. But for the most part, there isn't much to shake. This particular group of partygoers consists of 12 and 13-year-old girls, along with their male counterparts, and they are celebrating the birthday of a classmate in a suburb. The article goes on, and we don't have time to read the whole thing, but it talks about here we are, the feminist and post-feminist and post-pill generation. We somehow survived on our own teeny and college years, except for those who didn't. And now, with the exception of some Mormons, evangelicals, and Orthodox Jews, scads of us don't know how to teach our own sons and daughters how to not give away their bodies so readily. We're embarrassed, and we don't want to be, God forbid, hypocrites. Still, in my own circle of girlfriends, the desire to push back is strong. I don't know one of them who doesn't have feelings of lingering discomfort regarding her own sexual past. And not one woman I've ever asked about the subject has ever said that she wished that she had experimented more. Going on here, in recent years, of course, promiscuity has hit new heights, it always does, with sexting among preteens, hooking up among teens and college students, and constant stream of semi-pornography from just about every media outlet. I wouldn't want us to return to the age of the corset or the double standard, but it's easy for parents to slip into denial. We wouldn't dream of dropping off our daughters at college and saying, study hard, floss every night, honey, and for heaven's sake, get laid. But that's essentially what we're saying when we allow them to dress the way they do while they're still living under our own roofs. This is a totally secular view of the way that we are sexualizing our sons and daughters and sexualizing the relationships that they have even really early on in life. And so this is a great example of this idea, you know, of we have these great ideals for our kids, and yet somehow we're allowing the culture to pull us along into a way of living that's not going to get us where we want to go. Here's another example. Do we want them to have long-term relationships? So we're talking about everybody here said they wanted their kids to get married. And everyone said that they wanted their children to have children. So if we want them to have long-term relationships, and we want them to have a challenging intellectual development, as many people said, the women go to college and so on, if there were one single practical thing that we could do that was scientifically proven to make a huge difference in this area, would we be willing to do it? Probably. What is it? It's having dinner together. Believe it or not, and I'm sure you guys have all heard this. Have you heard about having dinner together? Mm-hmm. That there have been so many studies that have been done to show that that there's a huge relationship between having dinner every day, every weekday at least, and academic achievement and a lower teen suicide and so on. Kids just basically need us. And we don't have to be fancy, and we don't have to have lots of engaging things to talk about, but they just need us and to be around us and have somebody as a frame of reference who isn't just up here to them. So sometimes we're doing upside-down parenting. We say that we want one thing, but we actually do another thing in our real life. And realizing that attitude and moral development take place long before adult responsibilities begin. This is an interesting thing here, that what we're focused on today will most likely be their goals tomorrow, unless they rebel against our values. You know, and everybody gets all worried about teenage rebellion. Does anybody look at the teenage years and feel a little bit worried about what might happen there? Yeah, I think that all of us do. You know, we think about, oh, they're going to rebel. Well, you know what? They're not rebelling against our values, usually. Did you know that? They're usually not rebelling against our values. They're usually rebelling against our demonstrated values. What does that mean? They're not usually rebelling against the idea that God made them and created them and has important work for them to do. They're not usually rebelling against the idea that it would be a really cool thing to have a life that deeply impacts the people around them. What are they rebelling against? The shallowness and the perceived hypocrisy of our saying those things and yet allowing them to live a life that's totally fragmented, go here, go there, go there, go here, that's focused on material advancement and doesn't really focus on long-term profound relationships and spiritual development. So it's really bizarre that some of our youth today have to rebel against us in order to become spiritually minded. I had to rebel against my parents to become a Christian. You know, I had a lot of arguments with my parents in order to be able to go to Bible study and to waste my time doing non-academic things in order to have a more invested spiritual life. And I think that for us who are here as Christians, we think, well, that's ridiculous. You know, we're not that way. And yet it's just so easy to get into the living and running and allowing our kids to think that those are the most important things. And so sometimes they have to just rebel against us. One essential principle is that spiritual and moral maturity are not transferable. You know, I want so much for my kids to know what I know about God. I want my kids to have the experience that I have with God. I want them to have learned the things that I've learned because I've learned them at great cost. Many of the things I've learned at great cost with either great mistakes or great difficulties. And I want my kids to have the benefit of that. And it doesn't work. I cannot pull it out of my heart and put it into their heart. And the only way that they're ever going to have them is that the things that I believe and I hold firm have to be consciously taught and demonstrated on a day-in and day-out basis, or they won't be learned by our kids. We can't just pick them up and transfer them. They have to actually learn it and see it on their own. So in an uncertain world, what will make Zach and Zoe successful? The bottom line is a life of integrity. The thing that's going to pull them through, it won't matter what the economic times are. It won't matter if they can buy a house. It won't matter if they get to go to college or not. If they do, that's great. I am not against college. You know, I'm not against education. I'm a professional woman, and I'm proud of it. But, you know, it might not be that way, and it might. So none of those things matter, though, if they're people of integrity. What does it really mean? Integrity means that all the parts are put together. I was going to bring a flower pot today and smash it, but I forgot to go to my studio and get one. You know, and just think about, you know, when you have integrity means that it's all put together. But so often our lives are really fragmented. You say, oh, well, I like this piece, And I like this piece. Oh, that piece is a hassle. I don't think I want that piece. And pretty soon our flower pot can't really hold anything, can't really nurture and grow anything because we don't think about bringing all the parts together. You know, we want to have the relaxed, relational, sociable child, but we don't necessarily want to put the work involved in being the grounded and responsible and functional child as well. Well, we need to have a grid or a frame of reference, and that is integrity. So anytime a need comes up, a situation comes up, a decision comes up, should I put them in preschool this year or next year? Should I let them, you know, have whatever they want for dinner or make them eat what I cook? Should I let them have a play date with this kind of person or that kind of person? It all has to go through that grid of integrity so that we can make decisions. And I'll just tell one story that helps maybe a little bit. When we were living in Manaus, like I said, it was a huge city of 1 million people, but 70% of it was slum. And just immense social issues and social needs. And I was a nurse and running some health clinics and things like that. But we lived in a neighborhood that was like right right next to a large slum. And I would let my 10-year-old child go out and play street soccer. And street soccer in Brazil, it can be a pretty rough and tumble thing. And I had a friend at the school where my child went whose husband was the local manager of the Mercedes-Benz dealership, and they were quite wealthy, and they had the big house and the big fence and the pool and all that kind of stuff. And she was just outraged that I would allow my child to play street soccer with these kids from the slum. You know, that they were going to teach him bad words and that they were going to hurt him and all that kind of stuff. And it happened that the field, the where they played, was like right out my kitchen window. So I was like 30 feet away, but I could see, you know, at least that he was there and that he was alive and things like that. But I had a conviction about this grid that following, knowing Jesus and following Jesus is partly about being willing to mix it up with other people, and that we as Christians can't just like hold ourselves far away from that, from other people and from the realities of life, and that if my kid suffers from some of these decisions, then it'll be a thing that will be a learning and positive thing for his life. So one day, he was going for a goal, and a kid grabbed him from behind and threw him down and broke his arm. And so I took him to school the next day to cast from here to here. It was a significant break, and she was right. You know, you let your kids play with street kids, they'll stomp on them. And so here I'm getting out of my car, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to have to talk to Betty, and she's going to say, I told you so, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I was anxious about that. You know, and she gets out of her car, and her kid gets out, and he has the exact same cast on. And I was like, what happened to him? And she said, oh, he was playing soccer by himself in the yard, and he tripped. Behind the 9-foot wall, all by himself, he had exactly the same injury that my son had out playing with the street kids. And I just thought, you know, God, I really needed this today. Thank you, you know. But anyway, you know where I'm going with that. Integrity is the grid, the frame of reference for all of our decisions about our children. The frame of reference is not, will he get hurt? The frame of reference is not, is it convenient? The frame of reference is not, what is everybody doing? The frame of reference is Jesus. And what kind of a person is Jesus? And what kind of a person do I want my children to be? And you know, it's so exciting to live that way, because it's a lot more on the edge. It's a little bit more dangerous than living in a protected suburban sort of a way, but it's so exciting. And it's exciting to have grown children who are thoroughly committed to serving God with their lives, you know, and to see another generation coming up. It's a really wonderful thing. What are the barriers to integrity? What are the barriers that we have in our own lives? Well, one of them is fatigue. Sometimes we get to a point where you think, integrity? Planning? Are you serious? Really? You know, and I call this survival mode. And there are times when we are in survival mode. You guys back there are probably still in survival mode with your baby. You know, I mean, don't worry about it if you can't think. You've got time. You know, I mean, there are just moments in life when it's just too much and too overwhelming. And during those moments, all we can do is really pray and pray that God will show us the moment when we can get, get our heads together and wrap our heads around the planning and the things that we need to do. So sometimes pure fatigue is a barrier to really thinking about integrity. Another one is entitlement. And so often I see this where you know, moms and dads are like, you know, well, I just work so hard and I do this and I do that and it's just so hard and I need some time too. I need some me time. In fact, one of a relative that I have actually at one point left her family, her 12 and 13-year-old kids, and moved to another city and went back to grad school because she was just like, you know, I've had it. You know, me, I need to, you know, it's my turn. And of course, that's a very radical, out-of-the-box kind of way to do it. And yet, many, many times, we don't stop and think about integrity. We don't do the studying. We don't do the thinking. We don't do the conversing because we just don't have time for it because we just don't, because we think we need, I got to do my me time. And you know what? Actually, the thinking about integrity is me time because it develops us as well. And it can be a really energizing time even when we're tired out. Another one is the Wonder Woman and or Wonder Man, you know, because we have some fathers here. But you know, the whole get it done, make it happen, I can do this, and I've got a plan and I'm pursuing my plan and everything's going fine and I'm in control and I'm gonna find the best school and I'm gonna find the best friends and I'm gonna make that play date and I'm gonna, you know, get my little play date card, mom cards to hand out and I got it under my belt here. You know, and then we don't stop and think. We don't stop and think, what about, you know, integrity? What about a life? And then another one is defeatism. Well, their peers are more important anyway, you know, or he's just this way, you know. I mean, that's just the way my kid is, and this is the way it is. And oftentimes that is you know, a real barrier to our believing that God can give us the tools that we need, and God can take us where we need to go, because he really can. But I think the most common barrier, frankly, with parents that I talk to isn't all that other stuff. It's simply a lack of reflection. It's simply just not thinking about it. It's simply being kind of like on autopilot and reacting to kids and reacting to circumstances and reacting to the demands of school or whatever without really thinking about it. So I really want to just encourage everybody to spend some time really thinking about, you know, what does a life of integrity mean? So in my life, you know, I had to cry out for help because I didn't know what to do. I really didn't know what to do when my kids were born. And I found this verse recently that I just absolutely love, and it's been in my agenda now for the last couple years. And it says, Lord, we do not know what to do, but our eyes are upon you. And I think that that's really a cool message for who we are as parents. You know, we don't know what to do, but God does. And he will show us. He will show us if we ask him. He's that kind of a God, and he has that kind of a commitment to us. So what do I do now? I think that we need to just sit down with a piece of paper, decide what you want, what you really want. You know, when we talk about Zach and Zoe and go back to that first page, you know, what do I really want for them? And then define what that is. You know, if I say I want character, what exactly is character? You know, if I want, you know, whatever it is, define what it is and then commit to it. Commit to what we want. You know, I say I want my kids to develop long-term relationships with other people. Okay, who am I going to have in my life over his entire childhood? It's fascinating to me that my kids were in a play group from the time they were about 1 year old until we moved to Brazil when they were 5 to 7 years old, and then they hooked up from time to time on furloughs. Those kids from that play group are such long-term invested friends that they were college roommates. They're working colleagues today, some of them. And it's just a fascinating and an important thing that they have a history. They can look back and they have those long-term relationships. You know, how do we commit to what we want? I would like to recommend to you that, here's Winston, yeah. And he's not insane. These are not somber days that we encounter. They are magnificent days, the best that our nation has lived. And he is not insane. Because whatever comes to us, when we hear about earthquakes and wars and rumors of wars, it's okay. Because no matter what the logistics of our life become, God is able to bring us through it in a way, not just that we survive, but that we actually thrive in the ways that matter. I look at who do we admire in the Bible. These are three of the favorite people that I admire in the Bible. And all three of them, as teenagers, were either sold as slaves, captured by a foreign army and forced into a foreign school with a new language, or as a teenager, put in a position of social censure, you know, and a huge challenge, and had to run for her life to a foreign country to protect her young child. These are teenagers who encountered unbelievable hardship that we couldn't even imagine. But what did they have in common? Yeah, they had in common the enabling of the Holy Spirit, you know, and they had in common a God who held them in his hand, you know, and helped them. There is nothing we need to fear about the future. There is nothing, when we turn on CNN, that needs to get our blood pressure, you know, going and our heart racing, thinking, what's going to happen to my kid? Because God, in these circumstances, in any circumstances, holds them in his hand and brings them to maturity. We have unlimited opportunities before us. This is one of the most exciting moments in history to be parents. Do you believe that? It's one of the most exciting moments in history to be parents because we have unparalleled opportunity. We have the world at our doorstep in a virtual sense. Through globalization, we learn everything about the whole world. We can travel around most of the world. And we have refugees and immigrants right here amongst us. We have opportunities to have an impact on the world around us that have never existed before. And we have opportunities for our children to become people that could never have become before. We have resources to teach values that really make a difference to our kids. So when I think about success and happiness, I really do think about being realistic. You know, let's not be in a fairy tale thing. You know, it's very, very possible that our kids will inherit a world that is way different than our world, just as my world is different than Harry and Lola's world was. You know, but it doesn't matter because the God we have is the same. So and if we are pursuing those kind of goals, then we will produce a child who is so resilient and so tied into Jesus and tied into the people of Jesus that it won't matter if they have to grow vegetables in their backyard. It really won't matter. You know? And we need to believe that. We've got to believe that it won't matter that they don't have the same economic structures that we have today if they have integrity.